Very well then. Well, welcome back. It's been a while since I've been here at the Sangha, and I'm glad to be back. And as I reflected on what I might wish to speak about tonight and things that we could share our thinking on, usually what works best for me in terms of sharing some teachings is to think about what's really going on in my own life and my own practice right now, and what we sometimes call our working edge might be in terms of seeking to apply Dharma teachings and practice to the way we live our lives, and what seems to be going well, and what seems to be, I don't know, maybe a bit of a challenge. And so what I want to do this evening is to spend a little bit of time talking about the challenge work that I'm doing right now insofar as my practice is concerned. And I imagine that some of us may run into similar things in our own lives, and so it'll be just kind of a way to lead into our talking about the relationship between these somewhat rarefied or idealized states of mind that or states of the heart mind that the Buddha taught. You know, the mind qualities of compassion and kindness and equanimity and shared joy, right? These qualities of mind that, as he taught, are like seeds that are within our own consciousness from the time of our conception. And like seeds in the plant world, okay, whether or not they germinate and flourish into one of these mind states that becomes accessible during the course of our lifetimes depends on causes and conditions. You know, with seeds in the ground, it's whether or not there is nutriment in the soil, whether there's moisture, whether they can get air, whether there's adequate sunlight. When those things are present, that germination naturally occurs. With regard to the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas, conditions favorable for their cultivation include things like being here, being part of a Sangha, doing Dharma practice. Okay. Another thing that's really important is intention, you know, the desire, the wish for those qualities of mind to be able to come forth and become part of who we are and how we live. So the way these qualities of mind, the Brahma Viharas, houses of Brahma, got their name is a young Brahmin scholar who was studying, basically kind of studying for the priesthood in Brahmanism, and encountered the Buddha, and he said that it sounds like you achieve these very rarefied states that are supposed to be the fruition of Brahmanism, but you're not a Brahmin. How is it you can go to the houses of Brahma, you know, visit with Brahma? And so the way the Buddha laid it out, I said, well, you know, these states of mind are not really sort of out there someplace, and they don't actually depend on a relationship with an external deity. They lie within each one of us, okay? And they can be accessed by each one of us. We can find ourselves indeed imbued with those states of mind. And he said, once those states of mind are cultivated, okay, and we are within one of these divine abodes, one of these Brahmanic abodes, you know, and the 19th century translators used language that was trying to approximate where they were coming from as Christians. And so if you hear a lot about divinity in the heavens and whatnot, that's not really exactly where the Buddha was coming from, because he was not talking about out there, he was talking about in here. And he was talking about the wisdom and compassion that lies within each one of us, not that is bestowed upon us by an external deity. But he said, once you find your heart mind of the bodhisattva, the bodhicitta, once you discover that your heart mind is within one of these abodes, They become the windows through which you look at the world. The windows through which you see the world. Okay. And when you go through the door, they become the means by which you interact with the world, where the Dharma hits the dirt. Okay. So if we look at this Dharma chakra here on the altar, you know, this depiction of the Buddha's Eightfold Path, you know, we see the very earliest depictions of it, like this one, have a hollow center, you know, an empty center, you know. And that emptiness, it's empty but not really, because within that realm of emptiness, all things become possible. Okay. If the bowl weren't empty, it would not make that noise. Okay. So it is with our own consciousness, right? And so we cultivate, we help bring into being those mind qualities through inner practice. You know, whether it might be repeating the words and phrases or feeling them in your body or something like that. It's very much an internal or interior kind of a development insofar as bringing them into being. However, they don't really ultimately have the kind of significance and power they're capable of if you do not take them into the world. So, since retiring from the University of Colorado in June of last year, I've become increasingly active in various kinds of social action work, especially things having to do with the environment. And more recently, having to do with issues in the realm of environmental justice and social equity. And recently, I had the opportunity to become the coordinator of a newly established ongoing program in environmental justice and social equity within the Colorado Sierra Club. And so I've become increasingly active in program development in that area. And as I've become more active, as I've gotten more directly involved with neighborhood organizations and community groups and neighborhoods that are suffering very imminent and serious environmental health threats, I've found myself over and over and over again brought to my edge, you know, because of sometimes the frustration, the anger, the despair that can sometimes arise. And it became quickly evident to me as I became more and more involved in this work that the Brahmaviharas were not kind of an optional practice I could do when I felt like it, you know, and had the time. I quickly realized that they were absolutely necessary to this work. You know, and one of the recollections, daily recollections, my actions are my relations, my actions are my protection. Okay. I came to realize that if the Brahmaviharas were not an active, ongoing, engaged part of my practice, I would very quickly burn to a crisp and become ineffective. Okay. And so my working edge right now is how to keep things in balance, how to make sure that these Brahmaviharas are alive and well enough within my own consciousness and accessible enough and present enough that they protect me from what would otherwise be some pretty unskillful behavior in the field. And so what I want to do is spend a little bit of time talking about what some of those challenges are, fairly personal story, and then the trouble that I sometimes find myself getting into. And then what I want to do is to turn to, because what's really saved me, I mean, I can say these words and phrases all I want, but in terms of what really makes it possible for me to put them into effect, I really need to look around for examples of others who are doing so or who have done so. And so I'm going to share a few of those examples, and then maybe we can sort of discuss things all together. So our program is statewide, but right now a lot of our activity is focused in the neighborhoods of North Denver. Specifically, an area code 80216. And there is recently, and that's the Globeville, Elyria, and Swansea neighborhoods of North Denver, and the contiguous zip codes around them in southern Adams County. There is a Real Estate Research Institute report that came out a few months ago that said of all the residential zip codes in the United States, 80216 is the most polluted. You will not read that on Representative DeGette's website, which, and of course 80216 lies within her district. I'm sorry about that, you know, wisecrack, but I'm going to do everything I possibly can to keep, you know, to keep all this, keep it separate. I want everything I say about these cases I'm working on. I want you to understand that it's my point of view, and others have, you know, other points of view as well. This is not flat truth handed down from on high. This is coming out of me and my own perspective. The residents of area code 80216, who are about 80% Hispanic, pretty low income, have a higher, have a 40% higher rate of emergency childhood asthma attacks than any other neighborhood in the city. Okay. They have a 70% higher rate of congestive heart disease than any other zip code in the city. And that's controlling for socioeconomic status and ethnicity. Both of those conditions are directly attributable to exposure to highway traffic exhaust. Okay. I-70 runs right through the middle of all of those neighborhoods. Right now, the Colorado Department of Transportation is planning to widen I-70, and they want to do that by tearing down the viaduct and digging a subgrade portion of I-70 through the middle of these neighborhoods, roughly doubling the size of I-70, which is going to increase the existing air pollution by about 30%. Of course, I'm part of a lawsuit against the Federal Highway Administration for funding this. The Sierra Club is in partnership with some local neighborhood organizations, so I got to be pretty upfront about that. One of the things we're suing them for is that what we're arguing is that prior to undertaking this project, the environmental impact statement that they wrote should have included what's called a health impact assessment, which is to say, should have done a thorough survey of the health status of the people who are living in that neighborhood now, okay, and then try to get some idea of how much worse off they might be made if the freeway were to be expanded in the way that they're planning. And this is something that CDOT refused to do because they said the law did not compel them to do so, and therefore they weren't going to do it, okay. And so one of the grounds for the suit that we're bringing is that they should have, that they really owed it to the people who live in that neighborhood to do such a thing beforehand. So, in order to have a subgrade stretch of freeway, which is gonna be about 10 feet below the surface of the nearby Platte River, you got flood control issues to deal with, right? And so CDOT paid the city and county Denver $40 million to dig a flood mitigation ditch and an outfall in the middle of a Superfund site on the banks of the Platte River. What could go wrong? In order to keep that stretch of I-70 from flooding. Okay. When they decided they were going to undertake that excavation in the Superfund site, some of us over a year ago went to the city and said, please, and to the EPA, which supervises their work, and said, please do a health impact assessment prior to allowing this work to go forward. So we'll be able to fully assess any additional harms that might be suffered by the people who live in this neighborhood, and they refused to do so. The Suncor refinery in southern Adams County has recently made application to the Air Quality Division of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment to expand its refining capacity. Okay. The Suncor refinery is owned by the same Canadian mining firm, or is a subsidiary of the same Canadian mining firm that owns the Athabascan tar sands. And so the Athabascan tar sands are actually being, they're being transported down here to Denver by pipeline, and that's what's being refined at the Suncor refinery. It's the dirtiest fossil fuel feedstock in the world, actually, right now. In order to expand their refining capacity, which they want to do, and to refine this particular form of crude, one of the byproducts is hydrogen cyanide, which is the same gas that the Nazis used in the ovens in the Holocaust. It's the same gas we used to use to kill prisoners with in state penitentiaries. And so they're asking for permission to emit steady quantities of that going forward in their refinery operations, in addition to overall expanding the volume of output of pollution coming out of the refinery. We've asked the State Health Department if they would please make sure that there is a health impact assessment done on the people who live in 80216. Basically when you do an HRIA, you get a baseline idea of what the health status is of the people that live in the neighborhood, and then you make an estimate of how much worse off they might be made if this permission to do this thing were to go forward. And the State Health Department has refused. So now we have a situation in which we have a local government, a state government, and a federal agency that all have responsibility for the health and well-being of the people who live in that neighborhood, and they're not exercising it, basically. Okay. The principal goal with regard to the global landing outfall is to dig a flood mitigation structure for the expansion of I-70. Doesn't have anything to do with the health and well-being of the people in 80216. Colorado Department of Transportation wants to expand the freeway. They don't really, it's not even on their radar to take into account the health and well-being of the people who live in 80216, except to the extent that federal law compels them to do so. Okay. The Colorado Department of Health, you know, there is state law that they could exercise their discretion under to compel an HIA to be done. They have declined to do so. What the Air Quality Division has done instead is to incorporate by reference the federal regulatory structure for emissions at oil and gas refineries, which basically are weaker than the ones we used to have here. That same set of regulations right now is in the process of either being delayed or gutted. So in fact, by incorporating the weakening federal rules into the state enforcement regime, the laws are actually getting weaker at the same time that the pollutants are getting more deadly and increasing in volume. So at the present time, I spend quite a lot of my time actually either providing litigation support for our federal lawsuit under the Clean Air Act, liaison with co-plaintiffs, the neighborhood organizations. Spend a lot of time going to meetings and hearings with regard to the excavation of the Superfund site, and meeting with community groups and the EPA and with Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment with regard to the hydrogen cyanide situation at the Suncor refinery and the need to do an HIA. For 30 years, I was the director of the graduate program in environmental law and policy in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado in Denver, during which time I graduated hundreds and hundreds of people who now work in local, state, and federal bureaucracies. here in the Denver area, some of whom I encounter in these meetings. And I got to tell you that it breaks my heart. You know, sometimes I almost feel regret, you know. But, you know, they're doing what they consider to be best. You know, they're exercising their professional judgment, what they consider to be the best interests of the people of Denver or the people of Colorado or of the federal government. Okay, yes, please.
I was going to ask, what does our governor, what is his position?
Our governor is an extraordinarily good friend of the oil and gas industry, among other things. And the people in the state health department know this. Okay. He's been a strong advocate for the expansion of I-70 through Global there in Swansea since the time that he was the mayor.
He's a geologist.
Yeah.
Please.
I must just point out that this is at a time when there is an explosive, revolutionary thing happening in solar, electric cars. They're making a 50-year investment to the detriment of everyone's health.
We could certainly go there. I want to try to stay on track in terms of the theme for tonight. This background, again, I'm sort of giving my brief a little bit, which explains my perspective and why I feel sometimes such despair and whatnot. Again, there are multiple points of view that could be brought to bear on this. The upshot of it is that I really do find myself feeling rage and despair and just kind of bogged down. And I feel that to some extent, because I've been teaching these laws, you know, for 30 years. I know what the capability of these laws is if the people who are implementing them have the will to do so in a certain way. And I just don't see that being done. You know, I see these neighborhoods, in my view, being treated like roadkill. And what it made me feel of, it was highly reminiscent of when I came back from Vietnam, actually. There's a movie I highly recommend that I saw last night. It's called The Post. And it is an extraordinary film. It's just so well made. And the things that there are two things I found really inspiring about it. One is if properly use the power of a free press to prevent corruption at the very highest levels of government. Okay, if the people who are in the press have the courage to do so. Okay, and the other thing that was incredibly inspiring about it was the woman who owned the Washington Post, you know, Katharine Graham. It was. And the movie does a really good job of saying that this was a woman who gradually came into her own and became radically self-empowered by virtue of the position she found herself in and what she considered to be her moral obligation to do the right thing. And it was highly inspiring. The movie begins with a contract intelligence officer in the RAND Corporation, a fellow named Daniel Ellsberg, being in the field in Vietnam, going on patrol with a special forces battalion into a highly dangerous situation, coming under fire and whatnot. And then coming out of the field and briefing the defense secretary and others on what he found there. It was exactly analogous to an experience I had when I was in Vietnam in the spring of 1967. I was serving with a Marine battalion up on the demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam. And our camp was right near the airbase, the airstrip up there. And in addition to the Marine aircraft coming in and out, every once in a while, one of these little planes would come in. It was an Air America flight. Air America was a little airline owned by the Central Intelligence Agency. And they used it to move their people around the country. So this little Air America plane comes in. This guy gets out of it. He's in jungle gear. And he and I ride in a Jeep together down by where our camp is. And I said, where are you going? And he said, well, I got to hook up with a Ranger battalion here. I said, damn, what are you spooks doing here? I said, don't you know, this is dangerous up here. Don't you know there's a war going on? I said, yeah. I said, I'm going out in the field with a ranger battalion. And these people were actually doing patrols into the demilitarized zone and sometimes into North Vietnam. It was just, it's about as dangerous as it gets. And I said, why on earth is the CIA going on patrol with the Marine Corps? He said, well, let me put it this way. The President of the United States is feeling the need for an alternative source of information about what's going on in Vietnam. What he was saying is that President Johnson knew that his own military leaders were lying to him. We're not telling him the truth as far as what was going on. And this was as early as 1967. So he was sending the CIA into the field to find out what was really happening so that he would have a source of information independent from the military who were reporting to Defense Secretary McNamara. So it may mean that he maybe didn't actually even trust his own defense secretary the whole way. Okay. That's exactly what was going on with Ellsberg. He came back out of the field and he met with McNamara and others who were running the war, and they said, how's it going? Because he'd been out in the field before. And he said, the situation is basically unchanged in an 18-month period. They say, oh, right, so it means we're like bogged down? Absolutely, this war is going nowhere. So they get back to the States, and Ellsberg hears the defense secretary briefing the press talking about the great strides they had made and how great improvements were being made. So he knew then, just like I knew when I came home from Vietnam, that we were being lied to. Everything we were being told was untrue, you know. And that's exactly the situation Ellsberg encountered, and that's why he leaked the Pentagon Papers. He said, they've been lying to us for 30 years, and they're lying to us now, and the President of the United States now continues to lie to us about what's going on with this war. Okay. And I had come back from Vietnam with the intention of going into medicine, but I had risked my life saving people in the field in Vietnam, and then they went out in the field and got shot, right, again. And so it all started to feel kind of futile. And so when I came home, I came to the conclusion that, you know, we're sick, all right, but it's like the whole society is sick, you know, and there's a different kind of remedy that's needed. So that's why I went into the law instead, okay, law and public policy, to try to find out, you know, how our institutions of government could be made to work better so that kind of thing didn't happen in the future. And I went to work for my congressman, Morris Udall of Arizona, who had become a strong critic of the war by then. And he was also a consummate environmental politician. And so I think I learned more about environmental politics than I may have wanted to know during the time that I was working for him. But, you know, that became my calling, and I came to the, you know, to the point where I have little or no tolerance for people who don't tell the truth insofar as how they're exercising their powers under the law. And personally, I've come to the conclusion that I don't think that the government agencies responsible for protecting the health of the people in 80216 are doing their job. You know, they say they are, but in my judgment and in the judgment of the co-plaintiffs and the lawsuits we're part of, and the judgment of the communities that we're working to protect, they aren't either. So I'm dealing on a regular basis with a lot of anger and a lot of certain amount of despair. And occasionally I resort to unskillful speech in meetings and hearings, and I experience the consequences. And so it's really important for me to reflect on people who I know of who are doing, have done this work skillfully. One of them is a woman who attended this sangha for many, many years, who used to be a criminal defense attorney. I think she's since gone into mediation or something. But at the time, when she was here and she did some retreats with us and really took the Brahma Viharas to heart, And one time in a Sangha meeting when we were talking about these things, or maybe it was in Q&A on a retreat, I guess, maybe. She was talking about the practice of metta and how she dreaded every time she had to go to a court hearing because it was just her and her client, you know, and there is the judge and there is the prosecutor and there is the jury, and it was just, you know, it made her nervous and anxious, scared, with a heavy heart. She was doing her work. And then finally, when she started practicing the Brahma Viharas, she said, gradually, little bit by little bit, I felt the nature of my law practice being affected by my Brahma Vihara practice. She said, what I began to do, and I found that I could do it with increasing success over time. She said, when I go into a court, she said, first, before I go into court, spend a lot of time sending metta to myself. Okay. And the tensions that I know I'm working under. And she said, then when I go into the courtroom, first I send metta to my client. Because I know he, or sometimes she, is also scared and anxious. Because his future is on the line. I send metta to the judge, that he or she may rule fairly and listen openly to what I have to say. I send metta to the jurors, hoping the same thing. Then when it comes to the difficult person, she said, depending on who it is and how he or she has behaved, sometimes I can send metta to the prosecutor. She said, when I come into the courtroom now, I have adversaries, but I no longer have enemies. I have adversaries, but I no longer have enemies. There's a proverb in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. It says, all about us the earth is covered with sharp stones. We can seek to cover the entire earth with soft leather, or we can put soft leather on the soles of our feet. All about us are 10,000 enemies are arrayed. We can seek to defeat them all, or we can seek to defeat the hatred in our own hearts. Same thing. Opening the heart. And like Sharon Salzberg, a metta teacher, says, put no one out of your heart. You may or may not be able to offer the metta, but put no one out of your heart. Okay. So, well, something about metta. Something about karuna. In this case, fierce compassion, courageous compassion. I don't know if you remember a Pakistani-American named Khazir Khan. His son was an officer in the army killed in Iraq. And he and his wife, devout Muslims, were invited to speak at the Democratic National Convention in 2016. And he spoke on behalf of the American Muslim community. And he spoke out against the racist attacks that the Republican candidate for president, Donald Trump, had been levying against Muslims, whether it was Muslims in foreign countries or Muslims in the United States. And of course, shortly after his having done so, then candidate Trump viciously attacked both him and his wife, you know, for politicizing the death of their son. A few days later, he was interviewed on NPR and All Things Considered. And he was asked why he decided to speak about Donald Trump's sort of hate speech regarding Muslims when he knew that he was going to be attacked as a result. Here's how he answered. He said, I would have had such a burden on my conscience if I would not have spoken. In the midst of the grief, we don't set our conscience aside. There are some prices that must be paid, and there are certain concerns and certain hearts that must be touched regardless of the price. Someday, and I'm a strong believer, that when we appear in front of our God, I will have one thing to say about myself, that regardless of this, I preferred to comfort a scared heart. That's courage. I mean, that's real courage, you know, knowing that he was going to be attacked, and yet doing what he did anyway for the scared hearts of all the Muslims living in the United States. Someone needs to speak for them. If it needs to be me, then I will. Okay. So I find that a bit somewhat inspirational insofar as one's willingness to take that kind of heat, you know, stand up against that kind of threat, that kind of bullying, in order to alleviate the suffering of others, which is exactly what he did. Mm-hmm. As to mudita, selfless joy, in terms of working with difficult situations, painful situations, fear of exercising compassion because of the pain that it might cause oneself. This is in Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein's book, Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. Jack writes, when we allow ourselves to fully experience and directly experience the suffering, we find there opens around all this raw and hurting place a feeling of surprising spaciousness. When we don't add identification and reaction to it, the pain is just there as it is bearable. It is our task. The Sufi teacher Pir Vilayat Khan put it this way: overcome any bitterness that may have come because you were not up to the magnitude of the pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each one of us is part of her heart and therefore endowed with a certain measure of cosmic pain. You are sharing in the totality of that pain, and you are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. And in the Dhammapada, there is a teaching of the Buddha where he says, live in joy and in health even among the afflicted. Live in joy and in peace even among the troubled. Live in joy and in love even among those who hate. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. So, from the suffering comes compassion. From the compassion comes a certain feeling of equanimity, relaxation, of letting go. And that has the effect of liberating joy and open-heartedness. I've told the story in here before with regard to equanimity of Mahagosananda, who is the leader of Buddhism in Cambodia. And he happened to be out of his country when the Khmer Rouge overran Cambodia in the early 1980s. And the Khmer Rouge, you know, was an extraordinarily violent communist movement. And when they overtook the country, the first thing they did was to assassinate everyone in a position of authority. So first they assassinated all the government leaders, and then they set about assassinating the entire Buddhist clergy. You know, systematically killing monks and nuns in all of the monasteries throughout the country. Okay. When this began to happen, he heard about it. What he did was to begin to set up refugee camps around the perimeter of Cambodia to receive the peasants who were fleeing for their lives, and also to receive those monks and nuns, those monastics, who were able to escape rather than being slaughtered by the Khmer Rouge. And it seemed like, you know, his entire country had been ripped apart. The very people who were depending upon him for spiritual leadership and protection were being massacred, and there was nothing he could do about it. Okay. So he set up these refugee camps, and he helped people start little vegetable gardens and try to keep their lives together, even when it seemed that there was no cause for anything at all except rage and despair. And so several years afterwards, in the 1990s, he received a kind of a peace prize, an acknowledgement of all that he had done to take care of the people who had fled Cambodia. Eventually, you know, the North Vietnamese, by this time, they'd won their civil war, and Vietnam was unified. And although a communist country, they looked over Cambodia, these people are crazy. They're going to wreck the place. And so North Vietnam invaded Cambodia and crushed the Khmer Rouge, right, so the government could begin to reestablish itself. And so when he received his award, somebody asked Mahakosananda, how is it you are able to escape succumbing to being burned alive in your own rage and despair at what you saw going on, of having no hope your country would ever be able to heal itself? And he said, the entire time I was doing this work, seeing the refugees flee the border, hearing the stories of the massacre of my brothers and sisters in the monastic life, that whole time I was making peace with myself. The only way I could do that work was to continuously make peace with myself. That's what made it possible. Yeah. Kind of a tall order, isn't it? Why can't we all be Mahakosananda or Martin Luther King Jr., whose birthday we're celebrating tomorrow, right? So we have these paragons of extraordinary character and virtue. And sometimes it can seem unattainable that we could do that. But think about Pierre Villiac Khan's words, we have that little piece of, we have that little bit of that in us as well. And our ability to do what we can on a day-to-day basis, even though it's imperfect and even though we don't know what the fruits of our efforts are going to be, but to the extent that we can really sincerely try to come from a place of kindness and a place of compassion and a place of selfless joy, place of peace in what we do, that makes a difference. One of my favorite leaders in Mexican history is Benito Juarez. And he was the first indigenous chief justice of the Mexican Supreme Court. He was a Mexican Indian. He was the first indigenous president of Mexico. One of the things he said was that between individuals as between nations, peace is respect for the rights of the other. Peace is respect for the rights of the other. Respect for oneself and respect for the rights of the other as well. Okay, so please, comments, reflections, questions? I know I've eaten up most of our time, but it turns out I had a lot on my mind tonight.
So yeah, I just want to say I appreciate all the work that you're doing for the neighborhood. I actually live in the neighborhood,
yeah.
Neighborhood 216, and I'm part of one of the lawsuits. And it's been really tough for me. I mean, living in that neighborhood for 12 years,
yep.
In my perspective, and just seeing, how we've got all this wealth and prosperity in Denver right now, but there's a pretty big disparity with even among race.
Yes.
Racial. So it's certainly something that's right in our backyard. And for me, I've also been working with so much of the emotion, despair, uh-huh. just how, you know, frozen, you know, I can get near my own despair. I got a letter a couple of weeks ago from the person that was approving the permit. So the permit for Suncor to process some of the tar sands oil was approved.
Yep.
Despite the fact that they violated that and they actually evacuated this school because they were releasing deadly toxic fumes, just I think it was a year, year and a half ago. It had so many different violations. But it said pretty much, you know, in terms of what you've been saying along that theme, is that with a lot of these regulatory authorities, because the standards are so low, as long as there is a general description that these projects can move forward under you know the standards, even though it's not been proven, even though some of the modeling might not show that that's realistic, as long as they can put it on paper that these things are being approved. So it's pretty formidable.
One of the other issues we're raising with regard to the Suncor permitting is their emergency response plan. And as Joe points out, that refinery is about 70 years old and it breaks down all the time. And whenever it does, like the last time was when they had a power outage, and that's very, very bad news for an oil refinery because the first thing they have to do is do an emergency shutdown. And during which time an awful lot of really nasty stuff gets released on an emergency basis so the place doesn't blow up. And then when they do the restart, it's kind of the same thing happens again. And so one of the things we're pressing for is to make them have an on-site alternative power generation system so that they don't have to go through that. And they also, we want to look at their emergency response plan, which is secret, and it's kept only by the refinery, and the state doesn't compel them to make it publicly available. So in the words of my old Texas relative, so the Arabs can't get at it, right? I'm sure that none of the Arabs knows anything about how refineries work. but what we did learn in that last shutdown was that what their emergency response plan called for the people living in the immediate area, was what's called shelter in place. What that means for them is get under your bed and hold your breath. they would, you know, if they could at least issue them gas masks, but then that would be acknowledging there's a problem, right? So that's the kind of thing that we're up against. You know, I appreciate Joe's comments because it just grabs me in the gut, you know? And so, and Joe and I share that same working edge. You know, how these, you know, these agencies that are supposed to be taking care of us aren't. What do you do with that? What do you do with that? One of the things for me that makes it possible are a couple. One is doing this work with others. It's so important to be with others who are similarly engaged, you know, because you really draw strength from each other in that way. And commitment and focus and purpose. You know, even when it seems like the deck is stacked against you, I think about Mahagosananda. You know, it looked like his country was up in flames and Buddhadharma would never return to his country and they were going to live in ceaseless suffering. And then the Vietnamese say, well, I don't think so. You think those people need to go away? And they did. They took care of it, you know. And so, once again, Buddhadharma is back in Cambodia and Mahagosananda continues to be inspirational leader. So you never know what's down the road. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I've been struck as you were talking by how important the tool ecofeminism is to bring together some of the things that are going on. It fascinates me that we see ecological degradation, environmental racism, and the degradation of women all sort of coming
together. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
I don't think it's an accident.
You know? Yeah. We actually managed to get the Air Quality Commission to hold a hearing last fall on the Suncor repermitting. And so there are lawyers getting up and engineers and whatnot. the most powerful testimony of all was relatively young women with small children. Got up there nearly in tears and said, "We live in terror of what these people may do to us. And you alone can protect us. Will you or will you not do your job?" I was like, okay. Yes, please.
I just want to say thank you for the real world talk on how to apply the Dharma. I think a lot of us, whether we're working in environmental issues or gender violence issues, mental health issues, general health issues, there's so many challenges right now that are so overwhelming, and without those tools to keep doing this work, day in and day out and coming together, it seems like there would be no hope. It's tenuous at times anyway, in every way, but at least there's the ability to keep taking the next step and the next step. Thank you.
Thank you, Leah. And here we've gone, oh please, Ruth, one more.
Well, I think of something else you mentioned that fits here, maybe not with the form of the horrors, but to the importance of setting one's intention without having expectations.
Yes. Right. You do what you can do.
And then reset your intention.
Yes. You give it your all and then let go. Yeah, absolutely. Lisa?
I heard a story, I don't know if I heard it from you, Lord or not, that Ram Dass at some point in history put a picture of his political enemy on his altar and practiced loving and kindness.
Yep. Richard Nixon and
Caspar Weinberger.
Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense. He said when he was on his puja table and every morning he'd get up there and do his practice, he'd say, "Good morning, Dick." "Good morning, Casper."
I've also heard a couple of senior teachers quoted that they overcome with anger in what's going on in the world, that they have a daily loving kindness practice for Donald Trump now. And I'd just like to say that I'm not that advanced.
Nice work if you can get it. So we've gone and burned through another perfectly good 2 hours. Let's take our sitting posture again if we can. Allow the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Live in joy and in health, though subject to affliction. Live in joy and in love, even among those who hate. Live in joy and in peace, even among those who are troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. Have a safe journey home. Thank you, Andy. For those of you who would like to walk together back to your cars or your apartments, you can gather together outside this door.